You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live Podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. This is pretty cool to be able to do these conferences. It's pretty cool to be able to do these conferences over this amazing technology that, you know, what's left of our free market has provided us. So, it's a thrill to be able to do this today. I want to capitalize on what Ankar just presented to us. So, and talk about really three things. One is I want to talk about what a response would look like in an ideal society. And we've already gotten a good foundation for discussing that from what Ankar said. And I agree with everything he said. So I will take it from kind of way he ended and maybe develop a few more points regarding that. Second, I want to talk about what it would look like to properly respond to a pandemic like this in a society like we live in today. We live in a mixed economy. We don't have capitalism. What it would look like, what it would have looked like to have done it properly, objectively, with respect to the role of government in a mixed, but granted, we have a mixed economy in January. That when we first found out about this pandemic. And then finally, what would happen today if suddenly our political leaders had a conversion to the proper role of government? What should they do now to respond objectively, properly, consistently with their role and the role of the protection of individual rights today, given that we're in April and given that the virus is here and it's done the damage that it's already done and the government has responded already in the way it's responded. And I'm hoping that by doing this, you'll see what we mean by kind of the objectivity of government. You'll see what we mean by kind of an objective response to this. And you'll also see how far we are today from any semblance of what an objective pro-individual rights, pro-freedom government looks like. Now, I'm hoping to be able to do all that in like 20 to 30 minutes so we can have plenty of time for Q&A, because I know there are a lot of questions and people want to dig into the details. So let me get started with the idea of an ideal society, a proper government. And let's remind ourselves what a proper government means. Well, it means a government that is focused on the protection of individual rights as its sole governing purpose. That's what it is instituted for. It is a government that is our servant in protecting our rights, in protecting our freedom of action, our freedom to act in pursuit of our own values, in pursuit of our own individual happiness. It's a government that is completely separated from the economy. So it is a capitalist government. It is a government that separates, that has no involvement in the economic affairs of its citizens, in the choices, in the value choices that those citizens make. Again, unless an issue of individual rights comes up, unless, like in a pandemic, your actions become threatening to others. And as Ankar articulated, in a pandemic, the government certainly has a role. It has a role in protecting us from those who might inflict damage on us. Those who might be carrying the disease, carrying the infection, unbeknownst to them in most cases, but through their interaction with the rest of us, they would be inflicting real damage. And depending again on how dangerous the disease is, how contagious it is, and how deadly it is, you know, the response would vary, but so would the danger to all of us. And therefore, the response would vary. So, it is important for a government in circumstances like this, as Ankar articulated, to figure out the danger that is actually involved. So you would have this basic law, as Ankar articulated, that this is kind of, these are kind of the things that the government would do. These are the responsibilities. These are the powers that the government has in the case of the pandemic. But then when a specific pandemic comes about, what a government needs to do is first figure out how dangerous this is, how much transmission there is, to what extent rights are being potentially violated. Is this just the flu or the common cold or something like that? Or is this something unusual on top of that that requires some action? How deadly is it? To what extent is civilization at stake? If you've listened to some of Amesh Adalja's talks about pandemic planning, part of what he has thought about is what happens when you get a pandemic where 30% of people who get it die. You know, MERS, the Middle Eastern, which is the Middle Eastern, MERS, what's something, is a disease in which 30% of the people who get it die. Now, luckily, it doesn't transfer from human to human effectively. So it dies very quickly. The people die quickly and they don't transmit it. But also, human interaction, it seems, is it's very difficult to get this disease from another human being. So that's why it hasn't spread widely. But what happens if you get a coronavirus like, where a lot of people, maybe 30%, civilizational threatening kind of disease happens? The government needs to have a plan on how to deal with that in concept. In an ideal society, the first thing that would happen is that the CDC, the equivalent of the CDC, and I do think the CDC is a legitimate government function, that is an agency within the government, similar to the Defense Department, but dedicated to monitoring infectious diseases and having the skill set to be able to determine the level of threat that they involve and be able to provide the different branches of government with accurate, objective information about the threat and about the timeline. So such an entity like the CDC needs to exist, just like a Defense Department, just like a police, an FBI-like agency. Such an agency should be funded to the extent that is needed in order to keep monitoring and to have the skill set to be able to respond effectively, primarily with information, to what is going on in the world in terms of infectious diseases. So the first step would be to, within the executive branch, to approach the President of the United States and say, here's the new infectious diseases, here's our first estimate of risk, here's what we know, here's what we don't know, here's what we need in order to continue to monitor this, and we will continue to monitor this. This is what we think is going to happen. This is what we think the timeline is going to be. These are the resources and these are the steps that we think are going to have to be taken at that point. And the president should go to Congress and let them know that this is happening. He should make this information known to the American people. One of the characteristics of a proper government, of an objective government, is transparency. It is the willingness to, the lack of secrecy, the availability of information, indeed the constant flow of information, not just about what we know, but also about what they don't know, about the uncertainties involved, and about the process, about what is going to happen depending on how the virus and how our information, you know, lands up being, or what the information lands up being. So first step is put a strategy together, plan, and give the information to both Congress and the people. Second, once this becomes obvious that indeed this is a pandemic that's going to affect our country, Congress needs to pass a law specific based on the kind of the, call it the basic law, based on this umbrella law that gives, that spells out how these things should be addressed. It needs to declare an emergency. It needs to declare the specific pandemic, the specific threat, and declare specifically what powers the executive branch has in such an occurrence. And the bigger the threat, the more powers you would, I think it's legitimate to provide the executive branch in such a circumstance. And it should also frame, in a sense, what is reasonable for states, for local governments to do, and what is unreasonable to do. That is, what would constitute violation of individual rights for those local governments to do. And then you could imagine even that particularly if the threat was grave and the powers granted to the executive extensive, that this would have to be reviewed by like the Supreme Court, by the legal system. So somebody outside of the political mechanism says, yes, this is reasonable and within the boundaries of the Constitution, this is not a massive power grab by government when the threat is either unknown or the threat is minimal. But the more power is granted to the executive, the more certainty there must be about the threat, and the more certainty there must be about what needs to be done to address it. Generally, the more uncertainty we have, the less information we have, the more we don't know, the less government power, the less power the government should have over our lives. That is, if we just don't know what's going to happen, we have to let it happen. The government cannot take arbitrary power saying, we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but just in case it turns out bad, we're gonna stop life in a particular way, or we're gonna quarantine people, or we're gonna do all these things just in case. No, they have to have objective knowledge of the actual threat, what it constitutes, and how they're gonna act, and how that action is likely. You don't expect certainty here, but how that action is likely to address that threat. Now, for the most part, the action that the government would take are the actions that Ankar mentioned. Test, track, quarantine, or isolate, depending on the severity of the case and depending on the specifics of the pandemic. In rare cases, particularly if a pandemic is spreading very fast and there's not enough time to test and track and isolate, you could imagine local, specific, time-defined lockdowns that are very rare and very, very isolated, very kind of controlled in a sense of the timeline. You know, we're going to shut this down for 2 weeks and then we're going to free it up. And here's the plan for how we're going to free it up. You know, imagine, I was thinking of examples from other areas where the government has that kind of power to lock down a neighborhood. And remember the Boston Marathon bombing, when there was a bombing and there was these two terrorists on the loose and the government shut down Boston in order to hunt them down and chase them down and ultimately killed one and caught the other one. That seems to be a massive exaggeration. The whole of Boston was not a threat. And they did not think that the whole of Boston was where these terrorists were going. But neighborhoods, streets, specific locales where the threat that the terrorists are there, and in order to catch them, in order to subdue them, you need people to stay home for both their safety and the safety of the security forces chasing them down. It's fine to have a lockdown that's finite, where victory is clearly defined. We're going to unlock with specificity when these guys are dead, or when we don't think they're in your street anymore, when they've moved on to a different area. So the government has that power in times of emergency, but it's well-defined and very delimited, and the burden of proof, the burden that this is really necessary, is on the government. They can't just willy-nilly shut down places as is happening today all over the country because they might be a threat or they might be an overload of our healthcare system or so on. So in an ideal society, that is the scope of the role of government. Now, things like testing, things like vaccines, all of that, the government should, primarily the testing, because in order to test, they need testing kits. They should be working with the private sector, primarily be purchasers of testing and providing the public-private sector with whatever information they have. But I'm hesitant here to give too much specificity, because one of the beauties of capitalism, and I say this a lot in a lot of my talks when I talk about capitalism, is we don't know exactly how the system would evolve in the free market. So for example, to what extent will insurance companies already have plans to deal with pandemics and to deal with testing independent of the government, in coordination with the government or providing information to the government, but independent of it in terms of launching those tests? To what extent would hospitals, doctors' offices, and others have plans to deal with these kind of things? What other forms will a private response to a pandemic in its details take? And the answer is, I don't know. And the beauty of it is markets evolve and market find solutions in ways that we can't imagine. Uncle alluded to this with regard to sporting events. I mean, imagine an instantaneous test that could on the spot tell you if you had the disease or not. And you filled a basketball arena with people who didn't have the disease, and therefore there was no risk of contagion. Now, it sounds like science fiction right now, but that's only because we live in such a world where, you know, innovation is so restricted, entrepreneurship is so restricted by the regulatory state, by the FDIC, by the CDC, by everything else. But imagine a world in which innovation happened much faster, people prepared for negative events much more, people relied a lot less on government, and people thought about these things in advance, not just government, primarily not just government, but private enterprise thought about long-term circumstances because they couldn't just say, well, the government will take care of it. Why save? I'll just get a part of a stimulus package from the government. Why buy virus insurance? You know, and there's a question of what virus insurance would look like and how a market like that would develop given the systemic risk. So these are not easy questions to answer, but people would be motivated and incentivized to think about solutions for it when they know they can't just by default rely on government, because in a truly free market, in a truly objective government, government would have no role in bailing people out, even at the time of a pandemic. Government would have no role in the economy, period. And therefore, people would have to plan. Markets would have to adjust. So that is kind of an outline of what it would look like in an ideal society to respond to this. And again, there's a lot of optionality and a lot open depending on the type of risk and what the market's response is. But the government is going to be narrowly focused on the protection of individual rights and what is necessary for that. And that primarily involves identifying and quarantining people who actually are at risk of infecting others. Now, obviously, we don't live in such a society, unfortunately. We live in a mixed economy. We live in a world in which government not only intervenes in the economy, but maybe with regard to this specific, intervenes heavily in healthcare, where I don't know what the latest number is, but something probably north of 60 cents of every dollar of healthcare is spent by the government, where hospitals need permission for the number of beds that they have, where drug companies, vaccine companies, testing companies, even disinfectant companies, you know, for the disinfectant used in your hands, need permission from a government agency, a government bureaucracy. A condition in which the government is involved in almost every aspect of our economy. It cannot be that given that government, that when a pandemic hits, it's intervening in everything. But when a pandemic hits, we say, well, all we do is test and quarantine. We're limited government. We don't do anything else. I mean, that would be absurd. The fact is, whether you like it or not, you are responsible for the hospitals. The government is. It is responsible for that disinfectant that you use in your hands because, you know, you got an agency approving it. You've also got, by the way, laws about raising prices during a crisis, anti-gouging laws. You've got FDIC and CDC and limitation, again, on hospital bed expansion and who can practice as a doctor and who can practice as a nurse, licensing laws, and on and on and on and on. So any response, to be objective here, has to take all of that into account and has to take into account. Oh, by the way, government heavily regulates insurance companies and disincentivizes them, for example, from thinking long-term and thinking about how they would respond to something like a pandemic and then how they would pay for testing and everything in every respect. So you can't say, okay, it's blank slate. We're starting as if this is a free world. It's not. So the government has to respond in more dimensions than just test and, you know, track and isolate. So what would an objective government have done given the world as it is in January when the pandemic was discovered? Well, first, it would have pulled together the CDC, pulled together all the resources, the intelligence resources, the CIA, everybody, and said, what do we know? What is the information? What is the data? What are the risks? What is the upside? What is the downside? What can happen? And then it would have actually formulated a strategy. A strategy around, based on what they knew. Now, granted, there was limited information, but it was already known, certainly at the end of January, that there was human-to-human transmission. It was started in China. It was moving to the United States because there were flights coming into the United States. And that it primarily affected old people. I remember late January, early February, we already knew that. So what would they have first done? First, they would have communicated that information to the American public. They've communicated what they knew to all of us. Not downplaying it, not panicky, but just the facts. And they would have made certain recommendations. Recommendations about social distancing. Recommendations about isolating, not forced isolation, not coerced isolation, but voluntary isolation of vulnerable groups, primarily anybody over the age of 70. I mean, what has happened in some of the facilities taking care of older people is just horrific and was preventable. So imagine that they had come out with recommendations, old age homes should be locked down, people should not be allowed to visit, grandkids, kids should not be allowed to visit, people working in these facilities should be tested, they should be tested regularly, and they should abide by these hygiene requirements that we know or seem to help the virus. So given what we knew. And at the same time, the government should have brought together the FDIC and the CDC and said, look, we know you've got all this red tape that has to do with testing and has to do with approval of vaccines and treatments. Get rid of it now, quickly, as soon as possible. Go into emergency mode. They would have gone to Congress and asked Congress to do two things. One, to declare an emergency, because I still think that needs to happen just like Congress declares war. And second, allocate a budget for all of this. What would the budget would have included? Well, included testing. Given that the market is not working in testing, there are no buyers. Because insurance companies are not part of this market. Hospitals are really not part of this market. They can't just buy stuff without the red tape. The government needed to step forward and buy testing. Now, the way to make sure, and here there's an important principle. What the government should have done is used whatever market mechanisms are still exist in our world to facilitate the response. So one, testing, you don't negotiate the lowest price possible for the test and expect huge supply. Supply curves are upward sloping. The more you pay, the more you'll get. So pay people to produce tests and give them a nice, juicy profit so that they're motivated to produce more tests. And at some point, there'll be so many tests out there available for purchase, you can drop the price. Same thing. You can't expect hospitals to take care of all the PPE, the protective gear. You can't expect hospitals to take care of all the ventilators because you've disincentivized them for decades from doing exactly that. And you've made sure that they're not too profitable. That's what Medicare, Medicaid, and state and federal regulations of hospital do. Made sure they're not too profitable so they don't have a capital account where they can go out and buy this equipment. So it's completely legitimate in an emergency like this for the government, in a mixed economy, for the government to step in and buy the necessary equipment so that hospitals aren't overrun. You could use the military to provide the kind of logistics and infrastructure to get things to where they need to be, to open up field hospitals, to get beds to where they're going to be needed. Now, this is late January, early February. This is not in late March and early April. You make certain assumptions or you prepare to deploy when the hotspots arise. So you test en masse, you have that prepared, you find ways to incentivize hospitals, doctor clinics, new entrepreneurs. I've seen entrepreneurs come up with all kinds of tests in different parts of the country, insurance companies, others to go out and do testing and provide that information to government. And then you track and you isolate and if necessary, quarantine the people who have the disease. At the same time, you ramp up production of necessary equipment and you hold it back until hotspots identified in order to provide that. You provide guidelines to how to isolate the people most vulnerable to this, people with certain pre-existing conditions. And as we get more data, we're learning more about those pre-existing conditions. And clearly, from the beginning, we knew people over 65 or over 70, isolate them within a house, isolate them in these facilities, homes, provide, and Congress could allocate money to help with that isolation. Again, given that we're already in a mixed economy. And then provide as much information, accumulate information, try to provide as much information as possible about the disease, not about how to treat the disease. You should leave that to doctors and hospitals and the professionals. But how to, just information about who is susceptible and how it's treated and where the hotspots and what is the data available. So that's what I would have done in January, early February. I think a lot of what we've seen over the last month, I think a lot of the deaths would have been avoided. I think you could have saved tens of thousands of people's lives by doing the right thing early on. And basically, listening to the experts, as Ankar mentioned, the CDC had a plan. Epidemiologists like Amesh Adalja had plans. They had worked on plans. There were plans on how to deal with the virus. They did not involve lockdowns, but they did involve getting ahead of it in terms of information. It did involve testing. And that would have required very early on for the executive branch to basically tell and pass whatever laws you need in Congress to free up, to eliminate the red tape, and to allow for all this. And the same, by the way, with licensing laws and all the other laws that restrict the supply of products. And I would have gotten rid of anti-gouging laws, made them illegal at the state level, allowed supermarkets to raise prices on toilet paper, and all of these shortages would have gone away. So that's what we should have done in January. So what do you do today? Well, you play catch up primarily. The first thing you do in order to establish legitimacy, credibility, is the first thing you have to do is admit to all the mistakes you've made. So the government should today admit to the errors that have been made, admit to the massive failure in testing, in isolation, in tracking, but primarily in testing, and identify what the problem was, where were the bottlenecks, what happened, what were the bad decisions made. Because only then should any rational individual trust you to do anything right going forward. I need to know that you know what you did wrong. Second, admit that lockdowns were just a panicky response, partially the consequence of the fact that we failed in testing. And admit that it is inappropriate to lock down whole cities, whole states. It's just bizarre. Irrespective of the local conditions, lock down a whole state. And it is wrong, not an appropriate response to an epidemic, and not an appropriate response for America, not an appropriate response for any government that respects individual rights. Admit that you're still not caught up, that you're still behind the curve, that this $2.2 trillion with a T stimulus package has no provisions for testing, has no provisions for actually addressing the problem, doesn't even really have provision for helping the people. If you're going to help people, you would think you would help the people who are at most risk from this, maybe help old people isolate themselves. But no, none of that. And then admit that you don't know much. I mean, it's stunning that because, of course, of the testing, we don't know how many people in America have infected. We don't have accurate data about hospitalization or about fatalities or about how infectious it is, what they call the R-naught, or what interventions work and what don't work, what medications work and what don't work. That's up to the doctors and they're still testing it and there's no. And then at that point, then you become credible, at least to some extent. And at that point, what you have to execute is focus completely on is testing, isolating, quarantining, tracking, undoing a lot of these lockdowns, figuring out if there really are hotspots still that require significant additional equipment, making sure it gets there. If there are places that are short on doctors, using the army or other states that might have low, you know, making it possible for doctors to be able to step in and help out. Liberating pharmaceutical companies even more than they already have done to develop vaccines, to develop treatments, to test those treatments, to try those treatments. Trust doctors on the ground to test medications, to try different things. I mean, one of the, I think, an incredibly damaging thing that this administration has done is that the President of the United States has an opinion about which treatment is right and which treatment is wrong. He's not a doctor. He hasn't run tests. He doesn't know. Yeah, other people have run tests, so maybe he's right. But that's what doctors are for. Maybe that's what the CDC is for in the world in which we live today, looking at different treatments and advising doctors on what seems to be working and what's not. But the CDC doesn't agree with the president. But it can't be politicized. I see today online people saying Republicans all think that the malaria drug is good and Democrats think the malaria drug is bad, irrespective of science, facts, medicine, reality. So a real focus on reality, on facts, and on liberating the system as much as possible for all of that to be applied. It's still the case that in spite of our mixed economy and in spite of how bad things are, we should rely primarily on voluntary decision-making of individuals. The voluntary decision-making, and we should instruct them and guide them and recommend that they do the hand washing, the social distancing, using disinfectant, all of that. Provide them with the best science and rely on people to do the right thing. And if people don't, people will die. And that's part of living in a free society. People make mistakes. People don't always do the right thing. And people do die. And to the extent that we can make people pay the consequences after the fact, it's a good thing. But with an infectious disease, that's not easy to do. In terms of large gatherings, you restrict them unless there's the kind of testing or whatever controls that you put in to make it possible. You advise people to wear masks. You do all the things that science tells us are going to reduce the threat. But if you start isolating, if you start testing en masse and isolating those that have the virus quickly and on a scale, and at the same time, if you isolate the most vulnerable and you protect the most vulnerable, then I don't think a virus like this needs to get out of hand. And again, if you provide the supplies and everything and you use the price mechanism in order to do it and you incentivize producers to produce and you provide the right incentives to consumers, then there should be no shortages and there should be no, healthcare supply problems. So the principle is decontrol to the extent that you can, rely on individuals to do the right thing as much as possible, and areas where the government is already involved, where the government cannot get out of quickly, like medicine. You can't do Medicare and Medicaid in 3 days. Then the government has to step in and do only what is necessary to deal with the crisis while minimizing the amount of power it grabs and the amount of intervention in individuals' lives that it takes on. So the goal should always be to move us towards more freedom, even if it's a slow pace, even if we have to, in some sense, take half a step backwards in order to take two steps forwards. All right, I don't know if I crashed or if you're still there, but I'll stop there. Hello, are you there?
Yep. We're still here. Can you see me?
So why don't you take some questions? Maybe Ankur can answer them. My audio is still on, but my computer's about to crash, I have a feeling, because everything's locked up here, although the audio is still working. So it will take me about 3 minutes to reboot, but maybe Ankur can answer a couple of questions, and then I'll be back to do more of the Q&A, because that was the end of my talk anyway.
Okay. So
I'll be right back.
Very good. We'll see you in a bit, Yaron. So again, we're streaming on Zoom, YouTube, Facebook. We're taking questions on all channels. And we have a question from Kat on YouTube. Basically, what do you think of the Canadian government's response? So we talked a little bit about, in general, what a proper government would do, and then what the U.S. government did and commented on that. What about, do you have anything to say about Canada?
I've read a little bit about it. I'm Canadian, so I probably should know more, but I don't actually know more about the response. It hasn't, to me, what I've read doesn't seem very different from the U.S. response. But if there's something more specific about the response that Kat wants to bring up, if she posts that, we could talk about that. But yeah, I don't know enough, and I haven't seen that there's something very distinctive about the Canadian response.
Okay, so we got a question from Facebook that's similar to a question from Mallory on Facebook, similar to a question from Mark on Zoom, that is kind of looking a little more broadly at the culture. And there's a lot of uncertainty in this situation, uncertainty about the nature of the virus, what we're dealing with, that sort of thing. And that's provoked a lot of fear. And I think Mallory's question, I think, is suggesting that kind of fear is maybe partly what's driving the kind of denial that we saw. So broadly, how do we deal with that issue in the culture? I mean, how can we help? Is it a result of the education system, misinformation?
I think this kind of issue is a vicious circle. The more the educational system and the wider culture teaches people, and especially young people, that you don't really have control over your lives. You're determined by all kinds of outside factors, some combination of your biology and your who happens to be in your community and so on. You're not fundamentally in control. Then you look for, well, okay, I need to turn over control power to someone who seems like they are in control. This is part of the growth of the state. Ayn Rand had a view, which I agree with completely, that determinism and dictatorship go together. If you tell individuals you don't have power, then someone has to hopefully have power. And so I don't quite understand how the state knows everything it knows, but I don't know. I don't know anything. So I'll hand power over to the state. And the more that happens politically, the more the political system makes it, yeah, you don't have control over your life because the government's making all kinds of decisions. And that makes it seem like, yeah, I don't have power, because you don't. So it's a vicious circle. And in this kind of case with the uncertainty, yes, I think an element is, well, the government must know what it's doing. So I'll turn it over to them. And if they tell me I have to shelter in place and be locked in my home, I guess that's what we have to do. And if you've watched, I think one of the reasons people should watch the actual conferences, news, like Trump's daily thing. You don't have to watch it every day. But if you leave aside a few of the scientists, like Fauci, when you watch Pence or Trump, do you think they have any idea what they're doing? When Trump is reading, do you think he has any idea even what the words on the page mean? He can't pronounce them. Do you think he even knows what? And so the idea that they know what they're doing, and oh yeah, if we hand them the power, if you actually observe what is going on, it's a complete fantasy. but this is part, they're thinking of American system of government. When it was about self-responsibility, self-governing, it was, yeah, I can do this. I want this power to make these decisions. I don't want to hand it to the government. And we're too much in a context now where people want to do it. And particularly when it's uncertainty. I don't know what's happening. Maybe they do.
All right. We got a couple questions on Zoom about insurance and what kind of restrictions? So could there be such a thing as pandemic insurance? And what kind of restrictions are there that would might prevent that from existing in the first place? And would insurance companies, so Mohammed is asking a question about this and David is asking a related question on Zoom, what kinds of policies might insurance companies put into place and what kind of restrictions prevent them from doing that? I guess you're on your back, so you could.
Yeah, happy to. So I think that, it's difficult to come up with a good insurance product for pandemics because pandemics are systemic. So one of the things that insurance companies do very well is they diversify. So if you have fire insurance, you don't just have fire insurance in one neighborhood, you cover many neighborhoods. If one you know, thing burns down, you don't have to pay out everybody, right? You're only paying out the house that burned down. With pandemics, it's difficult because it's systemic and it's widespread and almost everybody is going to be affected or many, many people are going to be affected. But, you know, I still think, I mean, insurance companies are unbelievably innovative and creative. Think about Lloyd's of London and the kind of things that they insure, anywhere from pianist's hands to you know, in 300 years ago, ships sailing across the oceans. So I think that if there actually was, if people actually planned long-term and thought long-term in this way and didn't rely on government for it, I think some kind of market would have developed that would do pandemics. The problem today is, and this is true of all kinds of systemic risk, but also localized risk, earthquakes, even fires, floods, definitely floods, is that insurance companies, price these things. They're very expensive because the risk is high. The payout is very high. So the insurance is very expensive. People don't buy it because they assume FEMA is going to bail them out. FEMA is going to cover this. So fewer people buy it, which makes the insurance even more expensive. And at some point, it's so expensive, nobody wants to buy it. This is what happened to earthquake insurance in California. And at the end of the day, the state comes in and provides earthquake insurance or sells earthquake insurance cheap, and it's going to bankrupt the state when there really is an earthquake. So the government intervenes, not necessarily by regulating, it intervenes by the fact that everybody knows it's going to pay out. So, for example, in California, the government provides earthquake insurance explicitly. FEMA provides earthquake insurance to everybody who doesn't buy the insurance that the government provides. Insurance companies will sell flood insurance to people who build homes on the coast in Louisiana and South Carolina. But it's really, really, really expensive, which should be a motivation not to build there, right? And in a free market would be motivation not to build it. But instead, the homeowners run to the government and say, wait a minute, they're gouging us, right? They're extorting us. So the government says, okay, don't worry, we'll provide you with insurance. So today, most flood insurance in flood plains and flood areas is provided by the government, not insurance companies. So the only way you would see what would happen in a purely private insurance market is to have one and to get rid of FEMA and to get rid of all the restrictions and limitations and backstops and that the government provides today in a sense with implicit insurance and also in the way it regulates insurance companies themselves. So there's no surprise there's no pandemic insurance when the government can write a $2.2 trillion check to cover losses of everybody in the world. Why would any insurance company compete with that? How could they?
Did you want to add to that, Ankur?
I just say, so I agree about the pandemics when they're at such a severity, but there's a way, like people think of this as the apocalypse, that I think it's important that it's not. So if you take this situation and the insurance was, if you need ICU care, now you've got insurance. Like, it's a very small percentage of the people who need that. And if a lot of people are paying in, it's random and it's, so I could see insurance for this guy. You can imagine if it's contagious and the death rate's 50% and so on, that it insurance companies go bankrupt because they didn't estimate it could be this severe. But a lot of this, I think they would figure out how to do.
Oh, by the way, a business interruption insurance, right? So businesses are going to be interrupted because of pandemic, but You cannot have business interruption insurance when the state, the government, locks down a whole state. Then the government has to back it up. They, you know, you can't. So insurance has to be, I mean, I can imagine a provision in the insurance policy, business interruption, unless this was mandated by government for whatever, and then they don't cover it. So yes, absolutely, they could develop it, but they're not going to, as long as government has the kind of power it has, and the government has the tendency to bail everybody out when it happens, making insurance superfluous.
And on a free market, so our friend Jonathan Honig posted a comment on YouTube that there'd be all kinds of ways of managing the risk, call, you know, secure, selling it off by a reinsurance or securitization, putting call options on pandemic risk. There's all kinds of mechanisms that would.
Absolutely.
So, all right. So given the situation that we're in and the path that we've taken since January, what about the role that the government has played in taking the issue of hospital capacity and making sure hospitals are not overcrowded? Is that a legitimate thing for them to be doing in general? And in this situation, is it something they needed to do?
So again, in a truly private market, no. The government has no interest in supply and demand. It is interested in people who violate rights, and the people who are violating rights are the people who have the infection, and that's their focus. And the market takes care of hospital capacity. And by the way, I don't believe there would be an issue of capacity. Hospitals are disincentivized. I don't know if you know about that. If a hospital X wants to grow its capacity, it has to get permission from the government. And other hospitals get to lobby to say, no, we've already got, it will drive down prices. And, you know, so there's this whole mechanism because of Medicare and Medicaid that drive that where the state is involved in how much capacity hospitals have. So hospitals used to have many, many more hospital beds than they do today. And over the last 30 years, as government has got involved more and more in medicine, capacity rates in hospitals in the United States have declined dramatically. And it's all because of regulation and government controls. So I think in a free market, no, there would be no thinking about, that wouldn't be part of what government does. But in the world in which we live in, where government is so involved in healthcare, I don't see how they can avoid it. In a sense, they own in quotes, 60% of the healthcare system. And they're responsible for it. And they can't walk away because there's no alternative mechanism for it. So I think right now they would have to, on a delimited basis, and again, use the price mechanism as much as possible, increased production. You know, again, instead of the $2.2 trillion for miscellaneous, imagine a focused bill that just got PPE, ventilators, and maybe transportation to ship doctors from place to place to where they would need it. I don't know. But you'd spend a lot less money than they're spending now if they just focused it on the true needs.
There's a lot to say on this question. So I think it's good if someone wants to, in the general Q&A, ask about this, because this, I think, should be taken as such a refutation of government involvement in healthcare, not the kind of Bernie Sanders line or we need full control. And if you think of, if they're really running the healthcare system and their view is, look, this is a really serious situation, why wouldn't you just divert money? So in $2 trillion stimulus, that's complete inflation, like they're printing the money. So why wouldn't it be, okay, we're going to reduce Social Security payments for 6 months by 10% and use all that money to spend on healthcare, because it's these older people who are going to end up in healthcare. And so we have to get the capacities. And there's nothing resembling thinking about prices and a market. And so, The idea that everybody needs hospital service right now, or there's a surge in demand, and they're not making money, they're worried about going bankrupt, it should be taken as bizarre and shocking. But there's a lot more to say on this.
You know about the testing so one of the reasons the shortage is the testing is because the government is paying $40 per test. And $40, I mean, labs are making a little bit of a profit, but not much. And the Abbott test actually cost quite a bit more than $40. So Abbott basically said, we can't produce it. So they haven't been, even though they announced it about 2 weeks ago, there are no Abbott tests out there, almost none, because the government is paying them below cost of what it costs to produce. Imagine if the government just said, okay, for the next 3 months, we're going to pay $200 per test. You're going to make a fortune off of this. And then everybody is going to try to make tests, right? And they're going to flood the market. The same with hospitals. Imagine if they told hospitals early on, given that they're paying for the patients, assume they're paying for the treatment of the patient, we're going to pay you X, but X is whatever the cost is multiplied by double it. And if you run the numbers, that is a rounding error in the stimulus bill, in the $2.2 trillion. It's a rounding error. And yet it would make most of the stimulus bill unnecessary because you wouldn't have to shut down the economy. You wouldn't have to do all these.
You've been listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. If you like what you hear, leave us a review, share with a friend, and subscribe to our other podcasts. This podcast is made possible by donors to the Ayn Rand Institute. Help support this podcast by becoming an ARI member. Go to AynRand.org/membership.